Club. Driving. No purchase necessary.
You're listening to Radio Free Urbanism.
Hello and welcome back to Radio Free Urbanism, a fantastic podcast about urbanism and stuff. My name is Alex Williams, and I've got two co-hosts here with me today. We've got Nick Laporte, as usual. Say hi, Nick.
Welcome back, everybody.
And where is Ethan? He's been replaced with Yute Lee. Say hi.
Hello, hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's an honor to be on the show. I didn't realize I was replacing a co-host, and I feel like I've got some big shoes to fill here. So
you do.
It's not permanent, folks.
Let's see what happens. Yeah, that's true. No, let's not spread some drama and misinformation just yet.
Yeah.
Not just yet. Yeah, we will later in the show. So we'll,
please let us know in the comments if you think we should replace him permanently.
Yeah, please. This is what we do with all of our guests. We want to find out. We're testing to see who we should kick
like
off
American
the show.
It's like American Idol. Yeah.
Text in now to Radio Free
months,
Urbanism.
Yeah. The original three are not going to be here.
Yeah. Well, we like to switch it up. We like to keep it spicy. But Nick, speaking of spice, Nick's got an update for us.
I was wrong. Okay. Last week at the beginning of the show, I had an update talking about the Safe Streets motion that was supposed to be passed. And I was very pessimistic. I'm like, oh, no, it's not going to happen. The city council, they're so conservative. I was wrong. They passed it. They did some changes to it. Just a few little things, some wording and stuff. But it passed, which is fantastic. And there's the votes. It was unanimous in council. And there's the amended motion, and they just changed some wording around. But yeah, essentially what they're going to be doing is telling the staff of the city of Vancouver to make our local streets 30 kilometers per hour by installing traffic calming. And the one thing that I found interesting was at the bottom under C, I think, they said they changed what was the frequency or the volume of cars with the speed of motor vehicle traffic. Although in that section, it says about designating these to AAA cycling infrastructure, including modal filters, which should reduce the frequency of traffic. So I don't know. Watching it, and even Pete Fry, who brought this motion forward, seemed confused about what modal filters actually were. Either way, it's in there. The city staff and the engineers know what they are.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Traffic. So
that's all that matters.
Yeah.
Good job, city.
That is actually a huge win. So yes. Like these are the residential streets around Vancouver will be reduced to 30 kilometers an hour.
Yeah, the ones that are already bike routes are, 30 kilometers per hour. And if you watch some of my YouTube videos, I talk about them quite a bit. Are they 30 kilometers per hour? A lot of them aren't.
Yeah.
No. I bring my speed gun out there. People are going over 50 all the time. But generally, some of them are better than others. And this is going to help. Will it actually get... Hey, my pessimism is still here. Will anything actually move?
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. But anyway, hopefully it's a step in the right direction.
This is a huge win, and I'm hoping to bring a win to the podcast in a few weeks. But before I talk about that, I want to get a bit of an intro from Yute about your what brought you into urbanism, and kind of what perspective are you coming at it from?
Oh, good question. I have to admit, I really didn't know much about urbanism. Growing up, I mean, I don't think a lot of people do. Maybe that's changing now. But how it all started was I was just a high schooler that was about to graduate, and I had originally planned on going into engineering school because that's what my student counselors and my parents were telling me, that's a good stable job that you should get into. And sort of at the last minute, I had this sort of existential crisis and realized, just because you're, competent and good at something doesn't mean you necessarily enjoy it. And so I just threw a bit of a Hail Mary, looked around furiously for some other sorts of majors that were out there. And my mom's friend mentioned that there was this career called urban planning. Maybe you should check it out. And to me, that was good enough for me. And so I applied, and the one planning program that had it at the undergrad level, that was CIP certified for whatever that matters, was out in Halifax. And so I went out to Halifax and studied urban planning. And I mean, luckily enough for me, it actually ended up being a really good decision because I have just fallen in love with this field and the profession and the politics and the dynamics of it all. And as for what angle I'm coming from, you know, do I have like some sort of urbanist agenda? I mean, I'd say yes to something. I think anybody who works in planning, I mean, I'd be very curious to find any urban planner who actually, you know, is about like, you know, no bikes and walking and like we can build like a car city of the future, you know, a la freaking, you know, what was that Ford or General Motors convention? They had like a whole name for it. We can cut this out of the podcast if it's, you know, a very niche reference.
We hope they all died, the people who were those type of planners.
Dave H., at this point, yeah, if my math is correct, that might be a little bit, rest in peace. But all that to say, I think, you know, for me, what got me getting into the video specifically was this sort of observation that, you know, all of the stuff I was learning in school around, you know, I think the hot topic at the time was like transit planning and, you know, like how to make just the bus routes in Halifax a little bit better. It felt super meaningful and, you know, tangible. And I could really grasp like, oh, like that bus route that I'm taking, that's going to get a lot better. The frequencies are going to be better. It's going to connect to more stops. I was so excited about it as a student, but then talking to other students and just my friends in general, like nobody really had a clue of like that change was happening at all. And I really just felt like this is such a missed opportunity. Like this is stuff that people really, you know, ought to know to some extent, but also would naturally be quite interested in, I think.
Yeah.
And so that kind of initially drew me into, you know, at least trying out some sort of video around it. And I did it with a good group of friends.
That's awesome. That's fantastic. And I think you've influenced a lot of people to think about these things differently. And I think it's really cool that you wound up getting into it through this, through like a professional route. You're like, well, I guess that's what I'm doing for school. And then you're like, I guess I'm into it now. And whereas I think a lot of people end up getting into it professionally because they're, you know, especially nowadays, they're watching these videos on YouTube and then they're like, yeah, okay, I'm going to go study that. I'm going to make a difference in my community. So that's kind of, that's interesting to hear that's how you got into it.
And I've really seen that change. I think, you know, if you'd asked anyone like even 10 years ago, like what's a zoning bylaw or what's, you know, like, or like, do you know what an urban planner is? I don't think you'd really get much of a response, but it's so cool for me to see that there's just so many more people making content about planning that, you know, sort of car dependency, I think has really entered the public consciousness, especially for younger people.
Yep.
You know, one of my favorite subreddits, I don't know if we're allowed to swear here, but
let her rip.
Fuck cars. Man, to me, it's just awesome to see that kind of happen. And, it's been just a real honor to be a part of, you know, that sort of wave of interest in this subject matter.
Yeah. Yeah. The Overton window, I think that's what they call it, has definitely shifted to just like, people are like, oh yeah, I know about zoning. I know about redlining. I know about, you know, highways and all of this stuff.
One lane bro is a well-known name at this point.
Right? Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. People are familiar with it, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. We're going to have more questions for you later in the show. But for now, I'm going to mention my little update here.
Wait, hold on. Didn't even mention your YouTube channel yet. So
We should at least... everybody already knows. If you're listening to this podcast, you got to know.
They don't.
I appreciate the shameless plug. My YouTube channel is About Here. And I, you know, as I've alluded to, make videos on urban planning.
Yeah. And it's fantastic. Nick and I were talking about it beforehand. Every single video is like a film. Like it's like just like beautiful. Amazing. So if for some reason you are not subscribed to About Here, get on over there, watch every single video and like all of them, comment on all of them. It's fantastic, fantastic work. So my update is RCG is hopefully maybe coming to Calgary. If this is the first time you're hearing about it, it's basically a new zoning code Calgary made about 10-ish years ago that allows for row homes and townhomes to be built on what is currently a single house zoned property. And so depending on how big the property is, of course. So hopefully this passes. There are hundreds and hundreds of people signed up. The last I heard through whatever grapevine was there's like 600 signed up to speak at this public hearing next week, which means, and every person gets 5 minutes to speak, and some people will be asked questions. If you're just a normal human being showing up, you probably won't be asked questions. But if you're some sort of professional, you might end up getting asked questions. So this is going to be like a 5-day public hearing. If you have not signed up to speak, please, 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 we need all the support, all the help we can get.
601.
It's crazy. It's crazy. I'll be down there the whole time. And it's going to be like 12-hour long public
marathon.
Hearing. Oh, yeah. It's going to be something. I'm going to be very tired next week. But so let's hopefully pass this. Hopefully build a more resilient city.
I did the math, by the way. 600 times 5 minutes is 3,000 minutes.
That's crazy.
Alex, like, good luck.
How many hours is
bring
that?
Bring Red Bulls or whatever. God. Yeah.
3,000 divided by
60?
That's 50 hours.
Dang. Oh my, council time, need, staff can you, time.
Can you Twitch stream it and make money so that you're at least going to be able to?
I will donate. You know.
We've talked about setting up a Twitch stream. I don't know what the legalities are of simultaneously streaming a live stream of a public record. Yeah, I'll do a live reaction. Most of it will just be me building Lego sets or something, and then... And then, you can send me money to pay for all the Lego I'll be able to build in 50 hours of a public hearing.
Yeah.
It's going to be wild. It's going to be very wild. I want to pass it off to Nick for our first story.
All right. This is coming from one of my favorite cities in the world, New York City, and they are looking to drop the hammer on plate obscuring scofflaws. So if you don't know about this, this is something that's been going on for quite a while. And I recently learned about a guy, what's his name? I know his last name, but I don't want to say it without his first name. And now the video is not even loading. But anyway, it's this guy, he's the license plate narc is what they call him. And essentially he goes out on his own and records himself basically fixing people's license plates. Some people will put, you know, a leaf just kind of stuck in their license plate cover so that the plate can't be read by cameras.
Wow.
Or he'll redraw the actual numbers that have been scraped off so that it's more clearly visible. And he'll even take off covers, those obscuring covers, and just kind of put them on the windshield. He won't steal anything. He'll just make the cars compliant. And he says most of these cars, a lot of these cars are actually police vehicles a lot of the times. Officers own personal vehicles a lot of the time.
Really?
Yeah. So I love this guy. Some people really don't like him. But in this video, it's worth watching. This is from Vice. It's the snitch trying to get ghost cars off the streets, like I said, from Vice. And they have a guy who's masked up later in the video. His voice has changed, who's basically saying why he thinks he should have the right to do that. And he actually installs those plates that swap up so you can get a second plate, like a fake plate to swap in for your actual plate before you go through a speed trap or something like that. And he says, well, I got places to be. Like, I can't afford all these tickets, you know, thousands of dollars of tickets. And it's crazy to see how much this happens in New York City. I didn't realize it was such a widespread issue. Here's the leaf again. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see the leaf stuck in there to obscure the numbers.
Wow.
Anyway, so the city of New York is looking to, like I said, drop the hammer. The current fine for obscuring defacing one's license plate in New York City is $65. So that makes it effectively profitable to do this to evade the tolls, cameras, and tickets. Because you could easily rack up $1,000 in a day if you're really going for it, right?
Yeah.
So it's brilliant. So they're actually, this legislation has been introduced in the city council to raise this to $500 for the first offense and $1,000 for subsequent offenses and make it a criminal misdemeanor charge instead of a civil violation. So yeah. I'm obviously going to applaud this because I think this is great. The idea of people skipping out on these things, especially to break laws like red light cameras and speeding, which make our streets more unsafe. Just drop the hammer. Let's go.
I mean, that's wild to me that like a lot of them are law enforcement officers just like breaking these rules as well. I mean, the irony.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You'll see in a lot of his videos, this guy. His last name's Kuntzman. I can't remember his first name. He's got a great name. I love it.
Kuntzman.
in a lot of his videos, he'll be showing you the plate that's obscured, and then he'll go over to the front, and there'll be like a badge right on the dashboard, right? Like very frequently. It's wild.
That is wild. That is really disappointing, too, how common that is. I haven't actually seen it that much. Is this more of a New York thing, just like because they have more tolls and cameras and stuff?
They do. And, you know, we could get into a conversation about here in Vancouver and the lack of cameras in the recent vote that happened a few months ago. But there, I did look it up, and I think it was around 2,000, just over 2,000 tickets were given out in BC for obscuring plates. And the fine was, I think, just over $200, like $230 for fines. Right. I can't imagine it's as prevalent. But the thing I did notice, and this is just my own observation on the fact, is that when living in Ontario, tinted plate covers are very common. Even my parents have them. And sometimes they'll come from the dealership like that. I see them all the time, tinted plate covers. But they're basically non-existent here. I don't know if I've seen one in BC.
Why does someone need it? Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Alex.
I was just going to say in Alberta, there's a fair few. I've never been to Ontario, so I can't speak to like that comparison. Yeah. But yeah.
I think for one, people think it's aesthetics. They like the way it looks instead.
It looks cool and edgy.
I don't get it. That's subjective, obviously.
A tinted license plate? Like,
yeah.
People are so dumb.
Maybe it's for people who go on the 407, right? The tolled expressway in Toronto. They want to try to, you know, not get the ticket, or not the ticket, but at least the fee for driving on the highway, which is close to what it should cost for most highways. It's like, if you don't have a transponder, it's like $30 or something just to go a few changes over. It's wild.
Huh. I mean, I think it does bring up an interesting and perhaps important consideration for anyone that's kind of, any city that's exploring more like congestion pricing and some of these things. Like, I think it's likely that some version of that will happen in Metro Vancouver at least sometime in our lives. It might not be there yet politically, but the Overton window does seem to be going there. But, you know, I think the enforcement will be an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
Well, and I think too, like, it brings up an interesting issue that when you just, when you use too many sticks, people, you know, they find a way around it, right?
Yeah.
They bring shears with them or whatever, right?
Right.
And so I think we kind of had this conversation a few weeks ago about what is the best traffic calming. Mm-hmm. And my answer was that the best traffic calming is just other options. Like, just make it, like, you have a congestion problem in your city, just make it easier, just make it more comfortable to choose other options.
And that's what I was going to say to you, Yute, about in Vancouver needing congestion pricing. It's like my prediction, or at least my hope, is that we won't need it because we'll have so many alternatives that it won't be a problem.
You bring up a really good point. I imagine what's going on in New York is like the downtown area that, you know, where you don't need a vehicle is just so ridiculously expensive that you've set up a situation where if you can really afford any place, you're going to need a vehicle. And I think there's, to your point, like, you know, is the best solution a stick? I mean, in some cases, it might be that we kind of just have to make the other options way more compelling and, convincing. Like, you know, I think there's a huge overlooked part of our cities in suburban neighborhoods where, you know, sometimes they're just seen as a lost cause. But like, I really, you know, don't see how we can, you know, kind of holistically change our cities without, you know, considering those neighborhoods as well.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? And I mean, also decentralizing our cities a little bit more, right? Mm. So that people aren't like, well, I got to go downtown. It's like, well, totally. How often do you have to go downtown, right? Like, let's make it just so easy and so comfortable to live in you know, closer proximity to our homes. Mm-hmm. And I don't think just in the way of having grocery stores and schools and all of those amenities near our homes, but also having other things like art centers, right? You know, why not spread out the arts instead of all being focused in one area? Why not say, like, you know what, let's do something over here. Let's do something interesting and community focused over here that isn't just like, well, you get a grocery store. Congratulations. You can walk to that, right? Like, I think we have an opportunity to liven up our our suburbs and kind of make them more pleasant places, especially as more and more cities start to upzone them and allow a little bit more density. We can make those places more livable on a broader spectrum.
You know, I never thought I'd like, you know, sympathize with drivers in this particular issue, but you know, I think I do. It's a bit of a symptom of this larger issue that we've concentrated so much of, you know, all of our institutions and economic activity into one place, and people are at this point like really forced to kind of drive into that. And I think, you know, as soon as you start tolling it, it doesn't surprise me that there's an incredible amount of resentment about that sort of dynamic. And so, you know, interesting.
Especially when there's not good options, right? Like if it were the case that there weren't easy and, you know, affordable options to get into Manhattan, which obviously there are. I've been there many times. So, like, come on. Like, there are options. There's trains. Right. There's ferries. You can get there. And that's the whole point. And it's again, it's the whole car brain, the car dependency. Everything looks like a nail when the car is the only thing you're wielding. Right?
Yeah.
That's a good point. Good point.
And we're going to get into some more car stuff. Some more people worried about where they can get their car and how they can get their car there and where they're going to put it when they get there. And that is with Banff. We've talked about Banff before on the show. Here, not far from Calgary. It's a big tourist destination. Beautiful place in the mountains. And they've been doing a pedestrianized zone on their main avenue for the past several years. I think this kind of started with COVID, and people have really, really enjoyed it. And they have electric buses that will run down that avenue. And other than that, it's just cyclists and people. And because obviously cyclists aren't people, but that's another conversation, apparently. We'll get into bikes later. But there's been kind of this battle going on because Parks Canada has wanted to stop the dining patios that Banff has had now that they've closed down these streets. They've said, we got to shut those down because it's the commercialization of the public streets, which... I mean, that's a take, right? But Banff Town Council said, we're just going to kind of like ignore that kind of ruling, that decision that you made, Parks Canada. We're going to keep doing this. And then we're going to have this pedestrianized zone and continue to have our dining patios out front and such. But then there was a petition made to say, no. Keep it closed to pedestrians. Don't pedestrianize it. And well, it was validated by the town council. And so now it's going back to town council for another conversation. And so we'll follow that story. But it's wild when, I mean, you don't park on Banff Ave anyways. It's just a road you drive on.
Oh, yeah.
And once you get to Banff, you usually just find a parking spot and you just leave your car anyways.
How many blocks is it? Because we talked about this on the show.
It's like three blocks.
Right? It's like...
Yeah.
This is over three blocks. It's not a lot.
No.
We're not shutting down like a main arterial here.
No. No.
It's like not commuters are going to be like, oh, no, I'm going to get to work like half an hour later. It's not a problem.
It's like one of those destination streets.
Yeah. Plus, it's a small town, largely populated by people who work in the tourism industry there, as well as tourists. And I also like, I want to note that it's really important when we talk about tourist towns to remember that there are people living there as well who might have, like, they might have some real justification to say, like, actually, no, this is a huge inconvenience for me. I don't think that tourist towns should only exist to serve the tourists because there are people working there. But, like, listen, everybody gets to enjoy pedestrianized zones. Why, like, right? Am I missing something? Like, am I confused? Do pedestrianized zones secretly suck?
Okay, well, the few times we get to have them every summer in Vancouver, it's an absolute party. It's insane. And they go on for like a dozen blocks most of the time, like in Kitsilano, or they do the main street. This summer, we're going to see the two blocks down in Gastown and see how that turns out. I'm sure it's going to be lovely. And that'll be a more, you know, test case for how it actually would be if it was permanent, because you actually see it not just for one day or 2 days, it's for several months. So like, this is a tourist destination.
Yeah.
Like this, I don't know how this could not be car free.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
This is insane to me.
I've never heard a pedestrian complain about a pedestrianized zone. I think it's right. All like other modes. And like, and I fair point. Like if this is an arterial or if this is a route that people genuinely need to get to A to B, you know, I think there's a sort of a trade-off you kind of have to consider, but it sounds like this is like the destination street of a tourist city. Like, It seems like a no-brainer of sorts, but I'm a Vancouverite. What do I know about Alberta politics? And
yeah,
you know, maybe yeah. You know, instead of patios, you need like it's the drive-throughs are what you really
yeah. You need. Well, you know what? Actually, might be a good way. Speaking of Alberta politics, maybe a good way to frame this would be look at Parks Canada, this federal organization coming into our town and telling us to shut down our pedestrian street. We won't have any of that in Alberta. The feds won't tell us what to do. So
well
maybe
played.
If we frame it that way, we can kind of get a little bit more. Have you heard they want to shut down the pedestrian street? I won't let Justin do that. Not in my town.
And make sure you mention Trudeau in the the phrase as well. Gosh. Yeah, if there's one thing Albertans can get behind, it's government overreach. And there's different ways you can frame that. You know, use that to our advantage. Zoning bylaws, maybe another example. But it's interesting to me that the commercialization of public space was brought up as the concern or as like a core concern. Because I feel like I've touched on this issue a couple of times where, you know, there's this real, I think, blanket reasoning of businesses in any kind of public space where, you know, if you're making money, you must not have the right intentions here. And I really wish there was a bit more nuance as to, you know, what different businesses do for, you know, the public realm. I think there's a huge difference between a bank or between a furniture store and a cafe and a restaurant and a patio, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, a funny anecdote I recently learned is for a lot of developers, they will actually give subsidized rents to cafes because it's seen as a draw that will attract buyers for the homes in that building because it's an amenity. It's something that, you know, will actually bring more people and create more value in sort of this neighborhood. And so, you know, I think there's a part of me that really wishes there was more nuance on this sort of matter.
Yeah. And part of the conversation, a few things people have said includes like, okay, well, you know, one of the concerns about this was that during COVID, because people had to spend time outside, not everybody could be in the store, is that a lot of the gift shops would put displays outside the storefront. And so that's like, that's part of the concern that Parks Canada brings up as the commercialization of the public realm. But the restaurant patios get kind of roped in with right?
I see.
And so I think probably a solution, something better that we could be doing is saying, okay, listen, we want to use this public space for this and this. These uses aren't allowed, right? Like we can say like, actually don't put your gift store display out here. We don't want your magnets on the public street, right? But then we could say that we do want the patios, right? Because it's nice when you're walking down a street and you see somebody, they're chatting with their friends. That's part of like the environment.
Right?
Yeah.
That's, all of these amenities make the community what it is. And I think like next week's podcast, we recorded a few weeks ago with Rachel from Studio Leonardo. We talk a lot about this, about community building and what it takes to turn a place into a place instead of just, you know, a throughfare.
Totally.
And it seems like this is exactly one of those places to be. And when you look at a map like we did before, I'll share it here, is that you see exactly what's around there. And this kind of brings up the concern that you might have is that, okay, if these blocks are now pedestrianized, you're going to be affecting, like, for example, people living along this street, maybe. That's a concern for sure. Like, you're going to have more traffic because Banff Ave basically turns into a highway as you head out of Banff, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, I have two copies of it. I wasn't even looking at it. I was looking at the wrong screen.
Oh.
Yeah, it goes to the highway, right?
Oh, yep. I see. Yeah.
So, but then again, like how much traffic is going to be generated right from across the river in the south side?
Right.
Like
right.
Not that much through traffic, I can imagine.
No, and Banff is pretty walkable. Like along the Bow River there, like there's nice footpath, right? Like quite comfortable, pretty accessible as well. And so, yeah, like we don't, you know, when you're in Banff, when you're in Banff, like the town mm-hmm. site, you don't need your car.
Mm.
You know, yeah. Like very few
town.
People do.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a small town. It's walkable, and there's transit. Like if you have if you have a pass for the gondola, I believe you can get on the bus for free and taken up to the gondola to go up the mountain. You know, so
hey,
it's like,
what do you know?
There are like great ways to do this. You can also take the bus to other lakes and other hiking trails and things like that. And so the car is kind of overrated in Banff. And somebody's going to say, well, I like to go hiking on the other trails. Good for you. That's perfect. Bring your car, right? Like,
sure.
I think there is a great use, a great reason for somebody to have their car in Banff National Park. But by and large, most people could get by. If we had a train from Calgary to Banff, we'd be golden.
Oh, one can dream.
One can dream.
And then so to Vancouver.
Nice. Yes. And then on to Vancouver.
Oh, that would be beautiful. Oh, can you imagine? Oh, my God.
Yeah. The thing that, I think about it. There's some beautiful, like driving that highway is stunning.
Yeah. How long would that train ride be if you had like a reasonably high speed? Like 5 hours? Probably?
Maybe you could get it down to five. Well, I don't know. If you wanted to do it in five, you'd need an awfully straightened out track. Mm,
yeah.
See,
and
punch through
so
a mountain or two.
You would just a few mountains.
Yeah, call the Swiss.
Let's go.
Honestly, it would end up being basically a high-speed subway from Calgary to Vancouver.
That's true.
Because it'd just be punching through mountains the whole way through. Which would be super cool, but
there's Kelowna. Oh, it's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. You'll just see it through a little peephole. They'll punch another hole in the mountain that you can
just see through.
Half a second. Yeah.
Was that light?
Was that my God?
The sun? I've been underground for 5 hours. Yeah.
I love it.
High speed rail to Vancouver is on my long term wish list. Mm-hmm. But not on any sort of expectation list.
Yeah.
It'd be cool.
Yep.
But we've got more reasonable fish to fry.
That's true.
I think that's fair. It's okay. We got Seattle anyways. We'll figure something out with them.
Yeah, you guys can be cool on the... I don't know if you've seen, there's this Canada car ride video. I'll have to share it with you guys. But it's like all 10 provinces are in a van. And they're all like just like bickering and insulting each other. And I'll send it. It's very, very
Quebec's about to just like jet out.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's like so the dad is Quebec and the mom is Ontario. And the Quebec is like, you want me to leave? Fine, I'll leave. And then Ontario says, fine, leave. See if I care. And then Quebec says,
I'll take the kids with me.
He says, I wouldn't give you the pleasure.
That's
it's
great.
Very, like, it's very, very well
on
done.
Point. Yeah.
Well, we'll get on to Nick's story. Nick's next story here.
This is a story, but I feel like it's a non-story. Either way, I'm going to share it here. So this e-scooters and e-bikes to be permitted on Stanley Park seawall here in Vancouver. So the park board has tweaked its bylaws to allow e-bikes and electric kick scooters on designated cycling paths in park-controlled areas of the city. First, let me say, if you're hearing this, you might already know that a lot of kick scooters and e-bikes are already on the seawall. But anyway, these changes come as Vancouver is set to launch an e-scooter rideshare program, and the use of micromobility devices continues to increase. And as part of the plan, City Council recently approved traffic bylaw changes, making scooters legal on streets with speed limits of 50 kilometers per hour or less and on Stanley Park seawall. So these are changes that basically don't do anything, but they just make it legal because people were already riding on streets that were, you know, 50 kilometers per hour. People were already riding on the Stanley Park seawall. But there's one caveat here that I think is very interesting, and it's for safety. The city engineering department is being asked to set up geofencing on shared scooters to digitally control their speed, especially in high traffic areas such as the seawall. So that would be probably less than 25 kilometers per hour, which should be their max at other places. So that's pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. That's wild that they can do that. Like just kind of a geofence override.
I wonder if there's something else we could do that to that would be very, very helpful.
Haven't got a clue.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
If you're watching this on YouTube, you can see some beautiful drone footage. This is, you captured this, Nick?
Yeah, I was supposed to share this as I was talking, but I got in there late. We need a producer on the show to like, get these things going, right?
Somebody behind the scenes that can cue all this stuff
love
up.
It.
Yeah.
But then we'd have to plan more.
Yeah. I mean, who's got time for that?
Alex, have you ever ridden on the seawall?
No, I have. I have walked on it, though.
Okay.
A little bit. Yeah.
Walking is very nice on the seawall. It's a long walk, though, if you do the whole thing.
Yeah. Outside of the airport, I have spent maybe 4 hours, maybe 6 hours in Vancouver. I've...
Not long enough.
No. It was beautiful, though. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And it was convenient having the SkyTrain right from the airport. That was nice.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I've got so much love for that specific SkyTrain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, this drone shot, dude, if this convinces any of your listeners to check out the video, this is so good.
I was just fiddling around with it the other day. I was like trying to figure out how to get decent shots of the seawall without harassing people. I think it turned out okay. But...
Fly a drone, you know, far, far away. Yeah. I gets it.
I kept trying to do the auto lock feature and it would immediately like zoom in on people. I was like, no. It's so close.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, but if you haven't ridden on the seawall, you'll know that it's pretty busy and it's not a place that you'd want to zoom around. It's not a place where you're going to see mammals, as we say on this podcast occasionally, zooming around to do a workout. It's totally inappropriate. Many of the places, it's not even passable with two people. It's single file.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just what it is because there's no way that you could possibly get past those people without having an accident. You'll occasionally see people going the wrong way. Usually that's closer to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And you just got to watch out for that. I haven't seen it, you know, on these latter parts, like I showed in this video close to the, that rock, I can't remember the name of, by Third Beach, but it, you know, is it going to be more dangerous? No, it's not going to, I don't think it's going to change anything. Cause like I said, people are already riding there.
No,
it's okay.
I feel like I'm just cutting you off. I'm new, guys. I don't know when to speak. I'm very used to being like, here's the script. This is when you talk. Okay, go.
No, I'm just really happy because it's something I want to recommend to people, especially people who are hesitant to get on two wheels. Like one of my favorite things to do with somebody is when they come to Vancouver is take them on a tour and show them my favorite places in Vancouver on a bike.
Mm-hmm.
However, some people, they can't handle it. It's too much. There's hills here. You gotta take them in a way that's not too many. But I almost killed my sister last time. She was hurting real bad. Like, I'm so sorry. But so for this to be legal, so I'm not like, it's legal, but here, take my scooter. And I'm sure it won't be a problem to be like, it's totally fine. It's legal, which it should be, which is awesome.
I love that. I mean, if you don't mind me quickly chiming in, I've really come to feel and think that a key part of encouraging people to cycle is actually having places to cycle that are totally just not about commuting, not about, you know, becoming a cyclist commuter, but really just like recreationally enjoying it. That's one of the places where people just try it out for the first time. And it's like low stakes. You can usually, you know, there are bike rentals and whatnot. One of my favorite anecdotes I came across recently was the town of Revelstoke in British Columbia. And I don't know if you know, but Revelstoke saw 188% increase in cyclist commuters between 1996 and 2016. And so like right now the mode share of cyclists is like 14-15%, which is nuts for a North American city.
And that's in a mountain town too.
Yeah.
Totally hilly, whatever. And I was asking around to some folks who are familiar with that area, like what the heck's going on there? Is it like, did they roll out like the best AAA bike lane in the world. And they're like, no, it's just that they, like, you know, in the 80s, the city introduced all these like wonderful mountain biking trails. So a bunch of people got hooked onto mountain biking. They bought some bikes and then they realized, oh, like this bike that I have sitting in the garage that I take out on weekends, I can also use that to get to work. And I feel like, you know, in many ways, the seawall kind of does something similar. It sort of really creates this sort of, because it's not really like a commuting route. If you know, if you've ever used it before, like it doesn't really take you efficiently to places.
Yeah, it'll take you anywhere unless you're going to the beach.
Pretty much. Right? Yeah, it's not a bad destination. But like, yeah. I think it is like such a wonderful like intro to people. Like if you get here, like you just, you know, you might, your first time might be walking on the seawall, but then you see all these cyclists zipping by and you're like, oh, that'd be a much more fun way to do this. And then you know, I think that's part of the Vancouver formula that we've got. It's working amazing for us. Yeah.
I still love it. Like I took that footage the other day and it was just so nice. And it's one thing, I'm like, if you're going to cycle at all, just do the Stanley Park Loop. It's the crown jewel of the city and it is absolutely beautiful. It's incredible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I like what you're saying, Yute, about the recreation kind of being like a gateway to commuting by bicycle, right? Like just somebody, because I think too, when you do it recreationally, there's no pressure, there's no stakes. It's like, hey, we're just having a good time here. Totally. And then when you realize like, oh, I can just use this to get around, it's also associated with fun, right? Like then you go out and you're like, well, this is just a good time. Like, why wouldn't I get around this way? Because this is like, I get the fresh air. Maybe I take a detour because I just like the view that way. Right. Like it kind of creates just this knock on effect of recreational commuting almost. Mm-hmm. Right. Like where you just can kind of like enjoy yourself on your way to work.
Mm. Well, and electric assist micromobility enhances that by like a tenfold. And we'll talk about
game
that
changer.
Later. We're going to be talking about e-bikes. So we'll get Sounds into great. That.
Yeah. But in the meantime, we've got some questions for you. We want to get to know you a little bit better before we get into kind of our listener mail segment of the show.
For sure.
Nick, do you want to, you've kind of thought out more
questions.
I've filled
in some questions here, but this one I got to strike off the list. And it was, do you consider yourself an urbanist? And I think we've answered that in this podcast, but
yeah. And you know, I mean, I don't know if this matters to anyone. I do want to try to make a bit of a distinction. I'd say like personally, I'm absolutely an urbanist and I really, you know, have a lot of personal beliefs and opinions on, you know, how our cities should be evolving and changing. But I do try, at least for About Here on the channel, you know, my philosophy and approach to stories always has been, you know, for lack of a better word, like, is this a balanced story? And am I kind of
right?
Appropriately taking all the perspectives. And I think, you know, to some extent, I feel like there's a bit of a functional reason for that, which is I really do believe a lot of the people we need to convince to, you know, get on board with this sort of stuff, they're people that would have some of these opinions and that would really, you know, kind of feel defensive or concerned when, you know, we talk about increasing housing density or, you know, removing a car lane or street parking to introduce active transportation infrastructure. So I really do, you know, as like, you know, the Yute on-screen personality, try to, you know, make it someone that is really trying to be fair to all sides. And I have a lot of trust that once you just put all the facts out on the table, you know, people can come to a reasonable conclusion about these things. You can really, you know, like regard, I mean, I think one of my favorite ones was this video on like why fewer kids are walking to school. And to me, I just felt like that was a video and a story where, you know, regardless of where you stand on, you know, bike lane politics and cars and whatever, it's something we can all agree is, you know, something worth being concerned about. And yeah. And so I really, you know, for the channel, especially, like to see ways that, you know, we can kind of bring all sides and all perspectives to engage on a planning matter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like that. And I think that comes through in your videos, that balance kind of journalistic approach.
Oh, yeah.
I'm relieved.
And that particular video is fantastic. It's one of my favorites that I've watched from your channels. Oh, and shucks. there's something in it too. You have a great drone shot of a high school. I think it's by 49th and Heather. Of all of these cars, right? Just like clogging up the street. And sorry, this is kind of off topic, but there's a short I made that's up closer to 41st and Heather when I'm talking about the bike lane gets clogged and I have all this footage of just all these cars packing through there. And I know it's from the schools. I went there on purpose at that time to talk about how all this these cars clogging this bike route reduces the chances that people are going to use it, especially people, the kids from schools. And people keep commenting over and over, well, there's a school down the street. I'm like, yeah, that's the point. That's the point. Yes.
It's such a, it's a vicious cycle. It's like, especially in that like kind of critical area in front of a school, that one sort of block kind of surrounding a school. Like if there's just a lineup of, you know, minivans and SUVs with really stressed out parents that are just like making all sorts of erratic decisions on like weaving in and out of, you know, lineups, it's, you know, no parent would feel comfortable sending their kid, you know, on a bike or on foot to that school. I really, I do get that. And I, you know, empathize for that problem.
Our next question here. So obviously we're like fans of your like work professionally, like it's just so well done. And so we want to know, how does the production differ between your own content on About Here and what you have done for CBC?
Oh, yeah. That's an interesting question. I mean, to some extent, I feel I'm a bit afraid that the answer might be quite boring because it's a lot more like procedural differences. My hope is that, you know, my content, there's some consistency in just like the way I produce it and the story and the way I approach the story. I think that's what I'm most precious about, regardless of whether CBC is funding the video or if TransLink is funding the video. I really feel passionate that like this is how I want to approach the story. And if you're, you know, if you have a, you know, a contract with me, this is like, you're hiring me for this reason.
Right.
But, you know, the kind of more practical differences, I think the main kind of a difference worth noting is that with CBC, I'm being hired and being brought on to create entertainment and content, just that will get people kind of onto their platform, CBC Gem, our version of Netflix. And, you know, so with that, like, I think I could have put it much more simpler. With CBC, I have just like full creative reign over what stories I pursue. So I pitch them and I give them a ton of ideas of like, this is the type of thing, the story that I'm interested in. And, you know, if there's any real limitation, it's more so that like my producer like doesn't get the story. They're like, you know, I don't think this is really relevant for the broader population. Which I can certainly disagree with, but you know, ultimately I respect that they have sort of an editorial control over that. With my YouTube channel and you know, anyone who's seen work on my channel, you'll probably notice that the vast majority of stuff, and especially, you know, content I've produced recently, it's with a partner. And you know, I'd like to be quite transparent about how that relationship works. I am being, you know, paid by, you know, a partner organization that I believe, and I feel like I've vetted them enough to feel like we have alignment on a story and how we tell the story. But yeah, at the end of the day, they are paying me to talk about an issue, and we share scripts, talk about, you know, what the story is going to be. And it's very much a process where it's not just my way or the highway. They have input, they have thoughts and expertise, frankly, on these matters. And I think that's kind of the big difference is like, you know, a lot of stuff you see on the channel, it's limited by, you know, I guess like who approaches, I don't know. What am I trying to say?
Who the partner is.
Who the partner is. And, you know, and there's part of me that does feel a little bit uncomfortable about, you know, well, there's certainly limitations to that model. And there's stories that I know, you know, I could do well pitching it to CBC, but I would struggle to find a partner to produce, you know, kind of for my own channel. But that's a whole other can of worms.
That's, you know, super interesting.
If anyone cares. I think at the heart of this is like this kind of larger question of like, how do people like us, like who create content around these issues that, you know, are interested in making a living about this, like how do we make it work? And, you know, my personal experience is that, you know, our local media outlets and I mean, even the CBC, like, they don't have deep pockets. They certainly don't have the deep pockets, the money and the budgets they used to. And it only seems to be getting smaller and smaller. And so, you know, admittedly, part of me, this has been a bit of a more like a decision based on financial stability. And, you know, I think, it brings up a lot of questions for me as to, like, you know, how do we make sure that we still have, you know, stories out there that have integrity, that, you know, can keep people like ourselves employed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's also, you have this freedom of expression, but also it's a synergistic relationship where they can help you make the story you want to tell better. That's fantastic.
Totally. I think that's the plus side of it. I mean, and frankly, yeah, there are a lot of stories I think I would have never done if some other organization or person or like planner had approached me saying, I think this is a really important issue. You should be covering it. And by the way, it's like my department has some budget to, like, you know, create an educational, you know, piece around this. And so, you know, like, I think, you know, the benefits of it are certainly there too. Like, there's, as you say, a very symbiotic relationship where I can lean on the partner organization for expertise, for data. And, you know, and I think for me, I've kind of taken that for the trade-offs it offers on some of the other end of things around, like, my own sort of personal, freedom and creativity around each specific issue. But I will say one thing, sorry, and then let me know if I'm droning on about this.
No,
this
one going.
Question. I do feel like, you know, I really like to say, like, I'm not like a, you know, a puppet. I'm not like out here just taking anybody's money to, like, you know, produce whatever story they want. Like, it, for me, where my editorial control comes in is in the decision making process for which partners I want to work with. And, you know, I field a lot of requests for partnerships nowadays, which is a great problem to have. And what it means is I can be really picky about, you know, like, who I think is kind of has the best intentions for a story and who I, you know, frankly would be the least pain in the ass to work with. So yeah. So that's the kind of the, how the sausage is made of it.
That's awesome. I appreciate that insight into your kind of creative process and your, like, and also professional process. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've got another quick question I want to ask,
sure.
And it's about one of your earliest videos on About Here, transforming the Granville Street Bridge, and you're seen standing with a pint of ice cream on a narrow sidewalk atop a bridge while traffic's whizzing past you, and you explain the proposed changes to the bridge, like adding active transport lanes, right, an elevator down to Granville Island, and a greenway for people to walk and enjoy a cold treat. So my question is, was the ice cream cold? And if so, how did you keep it cold?
The answer is absolutely no. It was so, I think at the very end, if you watch long enough, there's a bit of a blooper reel where I'm saying, like, this is basically soup. It's ice cream soup. And I didn't think that far ahead. I mean, I thought it was a clever idea because in the rendering or the sketch for this new plan, they had included like an ice cream stand. So like I guess the idea is that, like, you know, this pedestrianized, you know, crossing on Granville Bridge will have some amount of, you know, food and, you know, ice cream offerings. If anyone does eventually decide to set up a little ice cream stand on the Granville Bridge when this project is complete, they better have great refrigeration because it was, not great. No.
I'm glad to hear that, and I hope to see some actual cooling up there in the future. I know we have an active transport lane coming. Greenway, not so much. But we got one more question. I think Alex can take this one. It's kind of a deep dive.
Yeah. I want to hear, what is Planifax, and what inspired you to create that?
Oh my gosh, you guys really did the deep dive. You've unearthed some.
I've been subscribed to Planifax for a long time, actually. I've seen a lot of those videos already.
That is so cool. I appreciate that so much. And so Planifax was the very first YouTube channel that I helped create with a group of my friends back at planning school in Dalhousie. And it was, yeah, like, that was our foray into producing videos in this field. I like to kind of say that, like, this was, you know, the dress rehearsal in some ways, like, where I could really, I feel like if you've seen some of the PlanFX videos, especially some of the very early ones, I mean, I have so much love for them, and I don't like, you know, regret making any of them at all. But like, there's some hilarious little mistakes, or I don't know, mistakes, but like interesting stuff. Like, for example, there's the very first video I did on transit planning in Halifax. There are multiple scenes where I'm just holding a ukulele for no other reason than it's just there. I think maybe part of me back then thought this, oh, like, why not? Like, maybe it's a little Easter egg or something. But kind of, it for the person that has no context, you know, watching it, it is such a confusing part of the story. But I think in many ways, I have so much love and nostalgia for PlanFX and what it was, because it was, I really think, and I think I took it for granted back then, but having a group of friends that you are regularly meeting with to create videos like that, there's such a wonderful dynamic there. I complain about this a lot, and I don't want to sound ungrateful. It's really cool to be doing this sort of work and producing, you know, videos that I really passionately care about, but it's admittedly a work that kind of gets lonely sometimes. And a lot of it is just like me in my home office, writing, researching, you know, every now and then having calls, and, you know, I talk to some of the other YouTubers too. So there's a bit of that community, but man, like, I look back at the PlanFX days, and, you know, we would meet once a week in one of the meeting rooms in our school, and, you know, just like just talk planning, talk ideas. And I think there was a real energy with that, I think anyone who's interested in starting up this sort of stuff, I feel like I can't stress enough, like, I think that's what kept us going, even when it wasn't really financially viable in any ways. It was just a good friend group, and we, you know, hung out tons and cut our teeth on how to, you know, edit and produce videos.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I think, it's kind of the, if you want to go fast, go alone, but if you want to go far, go with friends. Oh. I know that's been like a nice thing about doing this podcast, is that we get to sit down every week and chat just like urbanism stuff. I know the other week it was, you know, just me, Nick, and Ethan for the first time in like a month or two. And we just spent like an hour talking beforehand, just like catching up and talking about urbanism and what we've been working on and, you know, and all of that stuff. Cause you need that social life as well, even when it's kind of linked to your professional life. You need that water cooler that you can come to and have those conversations. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's something I look forward to every week. It's an outlet for sure.
Mm-hmm. It's our little therapy group.
it really is therapy. We don't have a ton of time left on the podcast, but we do want to talk about e-bikes before we go, because we've been putting this one off. Nick, do you want to kind of lead us on this one as our local micromobility expert?
Yeah, this one comes from Andrew L. He says, my wife recently got an e-bike, and it's pretty much allowed us to go extremely car light. We only really use a car to pick up large cargo like potting soil, furniture, etc. While I was at first jaded about using it myself, I quickly realized its utility. Instead of huffing and puffing the 9 miles it takes to get to work on my acoustic bike, yes, I'm familiar with that, I zip through the hills on the shared e-bike. I'll leave the acoustic bike for when I want some exercise. Anyway, keep doing what you're doing. Love the show. Andrew from Silver Spring, Maryland. Thanks, Andrew, for the comment. Yeah. Do you want me to read the rest of these, or how do we want to
Yeah, let's kind of go through them a little bit, and we can have a conversation as we go through. Because we fielded these questions because we were like, hey, do you have an e-bike? You know, what impact has that had on you? I'm going to read this one because this is also a pretty big impact here. They said, I live in Reno, Nevada, and ride an e-bike and a regular bike. I bought the e-bike because I have a commute to work with over 1,200 feet in elevation gain on the return trip, which is, I mean, just like 1,200 feet elevation gain on the return trip. Like, going there, fine, right? But like, after work, I don't want to ride uphill after work, right?
No, that's the opposite.
Let me get the exercise in the morning. Yeah. So they continue. So the e-bike can make a daily commute a bit more realistic and practical. Even on the days I'm not feeling less motivated to, even on the days I'm feeling less motivated to ride. It has saved me a ton of money in annual transportation costs. I use my acoustic bike if I'll be parking at the airport. The local airport has bike racks adjacent to the baggage claim, or needing to leave my bike in an area where I'm more concerned about theft. They said, would totally recommend an e-bike to anyone looking to ride to work, especially in cities where the public transportation is maybe not quite up to par. You don't have to get anything too fancy either. Mine is a lower end 750 watt with Samsung cell pack. Don't cheap out on batteries. That's a really important note.
Pro tip.
Don't cheap out on batteries.
Absolutely not.
Maybe at this point, Yute, you can tell us a little bit about your personal e-bike conversion.
Oh, absolutely. I have been converted, born again. I was telling Nick and Alex before we started recording here, but I recently got addicted to the e-bike drug. And it really, what started it off for me was that our bike share here in Vancouver called Mobi, they rolled out e-bikes over the summer. And, you know, to me, that was kind of the perfect entryway, because, like, you know, I think for a lot of people, including myself, like, the biggest barrier to an e-bike is, like, really the cost of it, and just you know, that you just know that it's going to be a significant upfront cost for a vehicle you might or might not necessarily use if you don't know, mm-hmm. if you haven't ridden one before. And to me, just having you know, there's a Mobi station right outside my house, and so when I saw the e-bike there, I was like, oh, why the hell not? I'll give it a try. And man, I am so much more lazy now. I'll say that. When there's when I know there's a hill ahead of me, I'm like, you know what? Screw it. I'm going on the Mobi this time. And and for a sort of, you know, so to me, if there's anything I can add to the conversation, I'd say, like, another, you know, wonderful or part of this is, like, you know, bike shares getting onto e-bikes, I think, is like a really cool thing that's happening, and I think could be a real game changer in lowering the bar of entry for people wanting to try e-bikes, and also for, like, people who, like, kind of rely on e-bikes to have a sort of risk-free option. You know, you dock it, you forget about it, you don't have to worry about people stealing it.
It's so easy and so convenient.
That peace of mind is just priceless.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Yeah,
it's Mobi's problem, not mine. Really.
Honestly, I think if a city is serious about their climate strategies, you know, every mm-hmm. city, every major city has some sort of climate strategy, something, some document that says, "Hey, we're going to try and do better."
Yeah,
yeah. And I think the best thing any city could do is, like, make an e-bike bike share and get it all over the city. Make it easy mm-hmm. to access and cheap to access. And you'd be shocked. We'd also saved a lot on infrastructure costs, which is another conversation we can have sometime. Yute, do you want to read Jen's comment here on e-bikes, if you've got that pulled up?
I'd be happy to. Okay, so this is a comment from Jen Hall, and she writes, "As for what I think of owning an electric bike, life-changing for me. I've had chronic pain and joint issues, and the electric bike has allowed me to keep pace with others and gradually improve my fitness as I get stronger. 10 out of 10, highly recommend." I gotta love that.
This is important, because we've seen it a lot of places where elderly people or people with mm-hmm. injuries can get on the bike, and not only do they get on the bike, people who might have been using an acoustic bike previously actually use their e-bike more than they would have. So mm-hmm. it actually gets people to get outside and exercise more. And maybe it's not to the same intensity, but that actually gets very close just because of that increased usage. It's fantastic.
Yeah. I like what Jen says to improve my fitness as I get stronger. The other day, like during the winter, I've mostly been taking transit. It's convenient. It's easy. It works for me. But the other day, I did get out and I rode my bike to my favorite restaurant around the bend. You may have heard about it. I may have mentioned it before. So I rode my bike there. And on the way there, I was like, oh my goodness, like, I have gotten weak over the winter just because I haven't been riding as much. Right. Whereas in the summer, I was riding my bike at least every 2 days.
Right.
And but then, yeah, I was like, oh my goodness, like, my muscles have atrophied. And if I had an e-bike, it would just be like, you get up and you go. I'd also,
they could atrophy honestly, further.
Yeah, exactly. Well, or maybe keep a little more consistent through the winter, I don't need to be buff. I just need to, be able to get where I'm going, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, and Nick, do you want to take this last comment on e-bikes?
Yeah, this is from Drippy Hippie. I've been a car free. I've been car free for 2 years, relying on my standard bike and public transit. My commute to work is a pretty flat 2.5 miles, and they've even built a multi-use path that takes me most of the way. I haven't had any issues getting groceries, but visiting friends and family further away in my town was difficult at times. So I bought an e-bike last Black Friday. It's an electric Expedition with dual batteries. That's a great bike. I got to try that one at the Micromobility in San Francisco. It's honestly complete overkill for most of my trips. Yeah, it's heavy. It's a big bike.
Oh, yeah.
But it really helps me live car-free without any compromises. Yeah, and that's the thing. You can, when we talk about car dependency and we talk about the cars that people buy, these oversized cars, you can oversize your e-bike and still use it as a daily driver. And it's really not a problem.
Yeah.
It's just a little heavier. It's not that big of a deal.
Does it still come with the ego boost as well? If I have a small penis, will buying a large e-bike help me feel better about this?
I think it might. You can get some e-bikes that are kind of snazzed up a little bit, make you feel good about yourself.
Yeah. Bikes that say I have a big dong. Yes, that's
what I'm there. Yeah, maybe you could put a license plate on the back and put one of those, shaded covers over it, a tinted cover.
Yeah, get the nuts.
Truck nuts on your e-bike. Yeah.
Bike nuts.
Bike nuts. Bike balls.
I like that. Yeah, we should make a merch store and sell bike balls now.
The one thing, though, I really love about e-mobility, and mm-hmm. I think this is why I started my YouTube channel like a year and a half ago in the first place, was just how much it transforms people to get around and their willingness to do it outside of a car. And I actually got a comment on one of my videos 2 days ago from SCP Video Productions. And he said, I would have never opted for bikes until e-bikes came out. And now I ride my e-bike everywhere. Wow. And that's the thing. They actually cut into that crowd. So when we're talking about level of traffic stress, it's the fearless people who ride on the highways. It's the confident people like myself who will ride on streets and where there's cars and stuff. And then there's the interested but concerned only on separated or very low traffic areas. And then there's the no way, no how. It gets those no way, no how people to get on bikes. And that is fucking incredible.
It's crazy.
Yeah. E-bikes are total game changer. I'm completely sold. I think one day we'll have to do a whole episode just talking about e-bikes and maybe talk to some e-bike expert. I guess that's Nick. Nick's an e-bike expert.
Yeah. Well, not really. Expert.
You're pretty close.
at least on the podcast.
On the podcast.
Like Ethan's our in-house foamer. He's our transit expert, right?
That's true.
I'm the micromobility guy.
But. And I'm the Calgary guy. I just talk about Calgary.
Calgary expert.
He's a pedestrian expert.
Yeah, I'm a pedestrian expert. Sidewalks. Yeah, that's true. Real quick, as we wrap up here, we've got one last comment from Jen Hall here. She always asks us a question. Yute, if you want to read that question, then we'll all go around the horn and answer it.
Okay.
I'm ready.
Oh, yeah. So question from Jen Hall. You have the power to eliminate one specific make and model of car from the world. Example, a Ford F-150. What would each of you choose to eliminate and why?
Okay. I'm ready. I'm all unit.
Do it.
Alex, do you know what I'm going to say?
I don't know what you're going to say.
If I could get rid of one make and model of car from the world, just like erase it from the planet, just right off the surface, just gone, it's going to be the G-Wagon from Mercedes.
Okay.
It is the epitome of excess. The thing gets 13 miles per gallon and people are using it to pick up their kid or pick up some bags of milk. Like, it's ridiculous. And I know there's so many other cars like it. You look from the Land Rover, Range Rover lines, very similar size. But this thing is just a boxy mess. Subjectively, I think it's ugly. It looks like when people drive in this thing, it looks like they're LARPing, like they're off-roading.
Yeah.
Like they're pretending to off-road, but they're in this actual cage of luxury inside.
Yeah, it's the pavement princess
and these
thing.
These things cost, I can go down the street on Burrard where all these fancy dealerships are. You can see. Almost $300,000 for one of these things a lot of the times.
Wild.
They're insane. Anyway, that's my please get rid of the G-Wagons. And they're loud too. The V8s are loud. You hear them it's the sound of Vancouver car traffic. It's
you have my vote.
All right. Yeah. Who's next?
Do you have another one, Yute? Or
I'm kind of, to be quite honest with you guys, I'm blanking a bit because I've never really been a car guy. I know the cars my family members drive, but I don't think I would ban like a Toyota Corolla.
No, they're great. You know? I love Corollas.
So maybe as to Jen's suggestion, the Ford F-150. I mean, I think like the. For sure, the size of these pickup trucks has gotten so far beyond what I think the original utility of a pickup truck mm-hmm. was. And, I don't know if I can think of a specific one that's just so egregiously bad enough to ban, but I think just like, you know, lower the freaking size of the hood. Like there was a great video that Fort Nine published recently that where like one of the shots, he's just like literally sitting in the area where you open the hood, like, and you have the engine, and he's just sitting in it because, like, there's just that much excess space in that vehicle. Clearly, these things can be designed a lot more compactly. Get like an Apple engineer in their meeting room, and like, just like, let's just that front hood doesn't need to be tall, and for a myriad of reasons, it's a bad idea.
I just like the idea though. Apple would like reveal it, and they're like, "It's a bicycle." We figured it out, guys.
We solved the problem.
All right,
I'd probably go with a Dodge Ram. I've worked landscaping and stuff. We never used Dodge Rams. It was always like a Chevy or a Ford, or a GMC, right? Like the Dodge Ram too big, too. It's weird looking too. Like it just unappealing. That's the one I'd get rid of. That's the make and model of my choice. We did have other comments that were directed at Ethan. Apparently he's very popular these days. So we'll get back to those in a couple weeks, I think. But in the meantime, we're going to finish up here. And Yute, if you wouldn't mind telling folks where they can go to find you.
Oh, well, so my address is...
the second doxing on Radio Free Urbanism.
can I just first off say that thanks so much for having me on this podcast. And I just genuinely enjoyed the conversation and love what you guys are doing. So, it's a huge honor. And then as to where you can find me, if you just look up About Here on YouTube or Stories About Here on CBC Gem, if you're on that channel... some of my videos will pop up and, you know, just feel free to explore and watch whichever ones you feel compelled to. No pressure.
Fantastic. Yeah. Yute does amazing work. So we'll have all those linked in the show notes as well. Nick, where can we go to find you?
You find me on YouTube at Nick Laporte or on other socials at Nick the Door.
And for myself, you can find me at Humane Cities on Instagram and YouTube, as well as Unsprawling on Instagram and YouTube, specifically if you're in the Calgary area and want to stay tuned for all the RCG stuff happening here next week. Yute, you want to start our closeout?
I would be honored to. Car bad, train good.
Two wheels good.
And feet first. Thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back next week.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. For more episodes, find us on your favorite podcatcher or on YouTube at Radio Free Urbanism.